I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for all the thought and care they've put into putting together this conference under difficult circumstances. It seems to be going very well. I'm impressed. And again, thank you. So I'll be talking, of course, about the mathematical structure of quantum gravity. And I think most of us view quantum gravity as one of the most difficult problems in physics. And of course, we have a traditional approach we've taken to this, which is start with general relativity and try to quantize it and come up with a quantum theory of gravity. And we've run into various problems with that. The traditional longstanding problem that has been discussed a lot is that of non-renormalizability, which really is a short distance problem. And so there's been a lot of longstanding focus on that. That has been regarded, you know, in some quarters as the problem of quantum gravity. But I want to emphasize that it seems to me, and I think others agree, Dan mentioned something like this in his talk, that a deeper problem is that of non-unitarity. And really we encounter this when we study very high energy scattering, do things like make black holes. And really we are encountering a long distance set of issues that we don't fully understand in the theory. It's not just a short distance problem. To me, this looks like a more central and more profound problem. Now, in general, these problems appear to reveal a basic inconsistency between our underlying principles of physics. Those are the principles of relativity and the principle of locality, and the principles of quantum mechanics. And of course, those are the cornerstones of the framework known as local quantum field theory. The lower two cornerstones are the things that are really basically encoding that classical geometry and topology underlie our current description of physics, that space-time is a manifold. And the big problem has been reconciling that with the principles of quantum mechanics. And there are, of course, various approaches to this set of problems, strings, loop quantum gravity, dynamical triangulations, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the longstanding, or a longstanding focus of the various approaches has been this non-renormalizability problem. And I think in some sense, the unitarity problem has been less of a focus. These so far don't tell us how to resolve that problem. There are hints, but we don't know. I want to emphasize these various approaches are really still based on quantizing a classical theory, either starting with space-time or classical strings or something along those lines. What I'd like to do in this talk is advocate an alternative approach. So rather than starting with geometry and trying to quantize it, following this arrow and come up with a quantum mechanical theory of gravity, I'd like to start with what we're aiming for, which is a quantum theory, and then ask what kind of structure do we need in that quantum theory so that we can approximately recover space-time. Quite likely, it's only in an approximation that we recover space-time. I'd like to organize our thinking in that fashion, or at least advocate we consider that. And one of the things we can use is that quantum mechanics is a tightly constraining framework. I'm, in other words, saying that we should try to geometrize quantum mechanics rather than quantizing geometry. That would be a slogan for what I'm saying. So we might call this a quantum first approach to gravity. I've written some about this. Also, Sean Carroll and collaborators have taken a similar viewpoint. And so the starting point is that we begin with a quantum mechanical theory. And we also want to insist that we have appropriate structure that reduces in a correspondence limit, in a weak gravity limit, to that of quantum field theory together with general relativity. So that's really a central question. What mathematical structure within quantum mechanics gives a consistent theory providing this kind of correspondence with local quantum field theory plus GR? And of course, mathematical consistency is an important and implicit postulate in all of this. So my plan in this talk is to try to infer aspects of this mathematical structure. So first, how do we think about quantum mechanics itself? We'd like to incorporate gravity, so we don't want to assume classical time or space at the beginning. Some thoughts along these lines were developed by Jim Hartle some time ago in his Generalized Quantum Mechanics. But a while back, I was kind of bothered by that. It seemed to me this was not a general enough framework. It assumes the notion underlying it of histories and so on. And so I asked myself the question, you know, what are the minimal set of postulates for describing quantum mechanics in this short paper? And came to the conclusion, it looks to me like, you know, they're remarkably sparse if we want to get to the essence of quantum mechanics. We have a linear space of states with a with an inner product, so something like a Hilbert space, an algebra of quantum observables, linear operators, and I call them Q observables to distinguish from usual observables that, say, experimenters measure. And then, of course, unitarity in appropriate circumstances. So say if we're describing scattering in an approximation approximately flat space. And it seems to me that these are plausibly the universal elements of a quantum theory. Although, of course, this is not nearly enough to fully describe physics, particularly physics of gravity. So we have to add something to that. Now, an increasingly important theme for quantum systems, I'm sure many appreciate, is that of quantum information. And key questions are, how is information localized? That's sort of the basis for kinematics, description of kinematics. And how does it transfer? That's more of a dynamical question. Concrete versions of these questions are, for example, in the context of one of our classic problems, is a black hole a quantum subsystem? At least in some approximation, and how does information transfer out of one? And that won't be the subject of this talk, but it seems to me that there are quite possibly observational consequences of this, at least worth exploring, and so I'll refer to that paper. But let me also emphasize that I'm taking a somewhat different perspective with some current themes in the field. Elsewhere, you will hear the proposal that entanglement leads to quantum space-time in some sense. Here I'm taking a different viewpoint that quantum space-time is more the fundamental thing, and then you can talk about entanglement within that context. So that's just a comment on the difference. Okay, so in describing quantum information, how do we think about its localization? What is a quantum subsystem? In local quantum field theory, answering this question leads to an example of the kind of mathematical structure I'm referring to. So let me illustrate that example. But before I do that, let me warm up by just reminding you how we describe quantum subsystems for finite systems or locally finite systems like on the lattice. And there, of course, we can think about a Hilbert space as a tensor product of two Hilbert spaces which correspond to the subsystems. That's the standard way of doing it. And in fact, that's often taken as a basic postulate, or sometimes taken as a basic postulate of quantum mechanics. For example, it's postulate zero in some work by Zurich exploring the subject. So for finite systems, it's very simple. You might try to do the same thing for quantum field theory. So for example, if we have a manifold and some open set in it, you might ask, can I take the Hilbert space and write it as a tensor product of states inside the neighborhood and outside? There's actually a problem with this in quantum field theory, and that is related to the type 3 property of the von Neumann algebras associated with field theory, which you can think of as infinite entanglement between degrees of freedom on the two sides of the boundary. And so we don't have precisely that structure, and instead we focus on observables. Specifically, we focus on commuting subalgebras associated with such open regions. So we can have a subalgebra of observables associated with U. An example with a scalar field would be that field smeared against compact support functions with support just in U. And if we have two space-like separated neighborhoods, then the operators associated with those or with support in those commute. In fact, that's very important because that's how we encode the property of locality in local quantum field theory. And so we can think about these subalgebras really as defining our underlying subsystems instead of a product structure like this. So the basic mathematical structure in the context of local quantum field theory and this is described quite in more detail in Hogg's book, is something that comes from this basically network of subalgebras. Their inclusion relations and intersection relations between them, that such that they mirror the structure of open sets in the underlying space-time manifold. So they really encode the topological structure of the space-time along with the causal structure. So that's a basic example of mathematical structure on a Hilbert space that is encoding, in this case, space-time. So how do we think about subsystems in the context of quantum gravity? And I want to remind you that it's hard to imagine doing physics without doing this. This was really emphasized by Einstein in this quote that I've taken. Without such an assumption of the mutual independent existence or the being thus, we don't use words like that today, maybe, but of spatially distant things, we can't really do physics. It's hard to describe what the things that we do in physics. We really need a notion of localization of information or definition of subsystems to describe the kinds of things we'd like to do in physics. And so, of course, he was advocating doing that based on classical geometry, but in the context of quantum gravity, we shouldn't be doing that. We have to be doing something else. So in gravity, if there is a Hilbert space underlying gravitational physics, I think a very important question is there an analogous structure on it corresponding to quantum space-time, which reduces to the quantum field theory structure I've just described in the weak gravity correspondence limit? And for lack of a better name, I'll call that a gravitational substrate. What is it? What does that look like? What are its properties? So I'll take some modest steps towards inferring this mathematical structure of quantum gravity. If you think of quantum gravity as like a big iceberg, I'm going to think about the sort of perturbative tip that we can investigate. And you know, if you're talking about icebergs, a reliable place to start learning about their structure and about the nature of ice and so on is you know, chipping away at the tip before you dive underwater. Of course, there are some very profound questions and maybe bigger questions underwater, but we can start learning about those starting with the tip of the iceberg. So let's consider a scalar field phi coupled to gravity as an example. And of course, as I said, when gravity is turned off, we just have local quantum field theory and we have operators like this that give commuting subalgebras that are the subalgebras of localized observables. But now if you consider gravity, well, non-zero Newton's constant, this kind of operator is no longer gauge invariant. It's not diff invariant. It transforms under diffeomorphisms in the familiar fashion, where kappa is basically the square root of Newton's constant. That is to say it isn't a physical observable. And the underlying problem is that in quantum field theory, phi is something that creates or annihilates a particle. But when you have gravity present, a particle is inseparable from its gravitational field. And so you really have to account for that somehow. One solution is to think about dressed observables, including the gravitational field. There's another solution, which maybe we'll talk about more on Friday. But the basic way of doing that is to try to introduce an operator that accounts for the fact that in addition to creating a particle, you need to create its gravitational field, a so-called dressed observable. So here are some dressed observable basics, and a bunch of this has been developed in some papers with Donnelly. So let's think about working perturbatively about flat space and to leading order in the coupling. Here is the transformation law of the metric perturbation H. And what we'd like to do is write down operators which are diff invariant, which are gauge invariant. Alternatively, we can describe that condition as commuting with the constraint operator because the constraints generate the diffeomorphisms. So how do we solve this condition? And the solution that we studied is to construct a so-called dressing, which is a functional of the metric perturbation which satisfies what I'll call a key condition that it transforms under diffeomorphisms like this. And it's easy to see that if you satisfy that, then this composite operator is diff-invariant working to this leading order in kappa. So what's an example? Well, if we take our point x and run a curve off to infinity, we can write down a double line integral that looks like this, the so-called gravitational line. In this form, it was written down in this paper. So it's basically a double integral of the metric perturbation. And with just a couple of lines, you can find that this transforms, this satisfies this key condition under diffeomorphisms. Now, that's not the only one. There are many possible solutions to this condition. And basically, they correspond to the allowed gravitational. If you average the gravitational line over all directions, and that gives what we could call a Coulomb dressing, it creates the linearized Schwarzschild field. Another example, well, there are many possible examples, but let me just leave it at that. So that's a spherical average of the line dressing is the Coulomb dressing. Now, in general, when you have such dressed operators, you run into a problem with what we've already said, namely an operator-based definition of subsystems or separability. So specifically, the commutator of two operators at space-like separation no longer vanishes, and it's basically because the dressings of the two operators run into one another. And so we find already at this leading perturbative level a gravitational non-commutativity, but not non-commutative geometry as it's traditionally thought about. It's a different kind of animal. One interesting question is how big is that non-commutativity? And it's characteristically, well, you can show it's characteristically given by a size of order the gravitational potential of one of these particles. And that fits with a pre-existing statement made about when commutativity should fail, which was made some time ago. So again, the underlying physical problem is that creating a particle here has a physical effect here. And note that, by the way, this also connects to the whole soft charge discussion of Strominger, Perry, and Hawking, where one aspect of the gravitational field that you can measure is the soft charges at infinity. By the way, I noticed my video froze on my screen. Is everything okay on the other end?
Yeah, there was a short, you were like not hearable for 5 seconds, but it's okay now.
Okay, sounds good. For some reason it froze, but okay. I'll restart. Okay, good. Okay, so bottom line question is, given this problem with the standard approach to localizing information, or the one suggested in local quantum field theory, how do we localize information in gravity? How do we think about that? Let's start with a simpler example, which is quantum electrodynamics with a charge Q scalar. And so there, the underlying scalar field is not gauge invariant, but we can make a gauge invariant object by likewise dressing that. In a very simple example of addressing is to integrate the gauge potential over a line similar to our gravitational line. This is a so-called Faraday line, as originally described by Dirac. And so that is a problem or a situation with a similar story. And you might ask, how do you localize information in QED? So for example, if you create some charged particles in a neighborhood, they must have a charge distribution. And if you use this dressing, you might say you could detect properties of that charge distribution asymptotically by measuring aspects of these lines created by those operators. But the key point here is that you don't necessarily have to dress in a way that is correlated with the distribution of particles in this fashion. There are many possible choices of dressing. And Another choice that you could use if you are considering an operator which creates a collection of particles is to run all of the dressings to a common point and then run it out to infinity. And then clearly, if we're making measurements outside the region U, we're only able to detect the total charge and not features of the charge distribution. So there exist choices of dressing so that the electromagnetic observables in the complement of U are insensitive to the charge distribution in U. And so we have independent information associated with the neighborhood U, where we put the particles. And so this gives us a notion of a subsystem, which is now not based on commuting operators. It's a little bit more like a choice of states in U, which we can't distinguish, or in other words, a little bit like a factorization of the Hilbert space, which is something we said was a little bit challenging. So given that that's challenging, is there some way to fix that? Well, in local quantum field theory, for starters, let's go back to that. With no QED or gravity, let's consider a neighborhood and its complement. We said that the Hilbert space doesn't factorize. But there is a construction of what's known as the split vacuum, given also, well, you can read about it in Hogg, where you extend the neighborhood U into a slightly bigger neighborhood, call it U epsilon, and look at the complement of that. And you can do something like factorizing the Hilbert space. So specifically, if we consider an operator supported in U and an operator supported in the complement of the bigger neighborhood, we can look at the product of the two of those and take its expectation value in the split vacuum. And we find that the expectation value is just the product of the expectation values of the two operators in the vacuum. So in other words, this decorrelates the two operators inside and outside, disentangles those degrees of freedom. And so put differently, we could act with two different operators, AI and AJ, which have support just in the smaller neighborhood, and create states which are indistinguishable via measurements in the complement of the bigger neighborhood. And so this gives us a notion of a localized qubit in this context. You might call it. It gives us a way of localizing quantum information. The mathematical structure here is not that we're factorizing the Hilbert space, but we have an embedding of a product of Hilbert spaces into the full Hilbert space. And so that's starting to align with the QED story. And we can now include the electromagnetic field so we can dress the various operators in here, say with a line dressing like I've described. And then in that case, we have, of course, the ability to measure the total charge of whatever stuff we've put in here by measuring this line dressing. So we have basically a set of embeddings of the product of Hilbert spaces into the full Hilbert space, which is labeled by that charge. That's the one thing that we can measure asymptotically. And so we could call this an electromagnetic splitting, which is built on this construction of a split vacuum. And then, you know, going one step further, we could consider a network of these things, and that gives us a mathematical subsystem structure for QED. So really this gives us a notion of localization of quantum information in electromagnetism. Okay, so next step is what do we do in gravity? Can we do this for gravity? And I'm going to describe the at least leading order construction, and that's talked about more in these papers here. So in fact, we can do something similar with our dressed observables in gravity if we have a set of operators that we dress. We can provide a line dressing. It involves a generalization of the expression I wrote down, which uses an integral between two finite points, and so the limit as one goes to infinity gives you the expression we had previously. And you can write a dressing which satisfies this key relation by adding, you know, the dressing between point X and Y to the dressing between point Y and infinity, but then there's a kind of funny looking derivative term here, but you can easily show that this satisfies this important relation. And so this is something that's going to create a so-called standard gravitational field outside the neighborhood. And, you know, in this case, it would be a line-like gravitational field. But you could just as well use as your standard gravitational field, say the Coulomb-like gravitational field outside the neighborhood. It doesn't matter. That's just a choice. And the important thing, though, is that this is a way of doing very much like what we did in QED, setting things up so that we are insensitive to the details of the matter distribution. So to see that, let's consider generalizing the dressing of the field operator to dressing of a general operator. And so that's straightforwardly described. You know, if you have an operator A, a general operator, you can describe its dress version by integrating against the commutator with the stress tensor, that dressing. Likewise, we can dress a state in a similar fashion, again, working to this leading order. And then, for example, we can ask, well, what can we measure by, say, observing perturbations of the metric outside the neighborhood? And you can show that the commutator of the metric perturbation with the dressed operator just depends on the standard dressing that you have chosen together with the commutators of the underlying operator with the total Poincaré charges. So the total momenta or total angular momenta. This is where that funny derivative term comes in. It's what gives you the angular momentum part. So measurements of H outside the bigger neighborhood only detect the total Poincaré charges of the operator. And likewise, if you look at matrix elements of a product of the metric perturbations in two of these dress states, again, you find a similar thing. Matrix elements there depend only on matrix elements of the products of the Poincaré charges and on the chosen standard dressing, whatever you took it to be, to leading order in kappa. So what we have, this is a little bit technical, or has been a little bit technical, but there's a simple statement of the conclusion that we found a way of localizing information or defining a subsystem in quantum gravity. Let me just restate. We can have an operator that creates a matter distribution and look at the dressed version of that, or the dressed version of the corresponding state. And measurements outside the bigger neighborhood only depend on the total Poincaré charges and choice of standard dressing, and don't register other features of the matter distribution. And by the way, that includes, you know, trying to measure the soft charges, say asymptotically at infinity. So there's no extra information there. What is the corresponding mathematical structure, going back to our original question? Well, like in the QED case, what we are describing is something like a sum over a product of Hilbert spaces embedding into the full Hilbert space, where now those are indexed by the, say, maximally commuting set of Poincaré charges outside. And so this is the kind of structure that seems to be revealed. You might refer to that as a gravitational splitting. And more generally, like in QED, this suggests that we consider a network of Hilbert space embeddings, which really are replacing the manifold structure of quantum field theory. The Hilbert space factors would be something like the analogs of the underlying open sets if we were talking about classical geometry. So this is a possible way of approaching the problem of describing quantum space-time. Again, the basic underlying object is the Hilbert space, and then we have this additional structure on it. And at a minimum, quantum gravity needs to reproduce this structure in the weak limit, whatever the fundamental structure is. So I think we really are getting an important clue. This is the perturbative tip of the iceberg. So questions. First, is there a simpler way of describing this structure? It's been a little bit complicated. Secondly, what is the higher order extension of this structure, you know, working to higher orders perturbatively in kappa? And even more profoundly, you know, if we want to go to the bigger part of the iceberg, what does the non-perturbative extension of this look like? Quite plausibly, there's some very non-trivial and interesting things that happen involving the strong field behavior. So for example, if we consider an operator that tries to create, you know, a significant amount of energy in a small region, for example, if we have the region size small as compared to the Schwarzschild radius of the typical energy, then we expect the strong gravitational field to extend outside the region. And so, you know, clearly we're out of this perturbative regime, and you expect that that's going to supply important constraints. In particular, not all naive quantum field theory states should be allowed. There are limitations. This is a little bit like the holographic story, but really it's an area versus energy bound, not area versus entropy or information bound. And likewise, you expect that there are related restrictions on the inclusion maps that if you consider nearby neighborhoods, you can't excite too many degrees of freedom in those. And finally, we expect there to be a smallest Hilbert space as well. Some discussion of all of these is in this reference here. In the last few minutes, I'd like to just briefly describe the connection with holography. There is a connection with holography, and there's more exploration in these papers here. So, of course, a key question in holography, specifically for the ADS-CFT correspondence, is that's supposed to relate physical quantities in the bulk to physical quantities on the boundary. So, specifically, if we think about operators in the bulk and on the boundary, what is the map between those operators? And in my mind, the best candidate explanation for that has been an explanation given by Merrill some time ago and developed by Jacobson and others, that the explanation for that comes from the gravitational constraints. And the basic idea is you can take an operator here at the center and relate it to an operator up on the boundary through evolution. But then because the Hamiltonian in gravity is a pure boundary operator, you can evolve that boundary operator you found back to a boundary operator at the same time, say. So again, that relies on the fact that the Hamiltonian is a surface term, and that is only in fact true if the constraints are solved. And what I've just been telling you is how to solve the constraints by finding the dressing. That's the job that the dressing does, is tell you how to construct operators that commute with the constraints. Now, one key point, I think, in this argument is you really need to consider a large translation, over something comparable to the ADS timescale. And so that means that in order to make this construction work, you really need the dressing not just to leading order in Newton's constant, but to all orders. And so that's solving the constraints to all orders, and that is equivalent to really, I think, understanding the non-perturbative bulk evolution. So if you have that, plausibly you can construct this map between operators, but important questions remain as well on that subject, and you can read more about those in this latter paper.
4 minutes.
Okay, thank you. So that's the connection with holography, and this is the last slide. So I've said that trying to quantize geometry has led to multiple difficulties. Of course, non-renormalizability most famously, but now more and more people are realizing maybe non-unitarity is the bigger issue. I've suggested that we start instead with quantum mechanics and ask what mathematical structure on that is needed and reduces approximately to local quantum field theory plus general relativity. So again, this what might be called a quantum first approach to the subject. What kind of mathematical structure are we after? A key physical question is that of Einstein separability, you might call it. We need a way of describing separateness or subsystems, localization of information and so on. We need a mathematical description of that. And so we need some sort of quantum replacement for space-time. So I suggested a name for what we're looking for, but more importantly, there are key constraints on this, which we start to see already in perturbative gravity quite clearly. We can just calculate and find them. So we're exploiting this notion of correspondence with local quantum field theory plus GR and the weak gravity limit, and we find that this kind of structure is not quite a tensor factorization like in locally finite systems, doesn't involve apparently local subalgebras. It's not traditional non-commutative geometry, say a la Kahn. And the structure we are finding is more like a network of Hilbert space inclusions. So, really these are some first modest steps, but I think they are providing us important information. You know, more is needed, clearly, to formulate the full physical theory. And so we'd like a more complete version of the structure. We'd like to understand the evolution law in that context. And of course, as I've already alluded to, when you think about describing unitary evolution in the black hole context, quite possibly there are observational signatures. So I don't have time to describe that. I'll send you to this reference if you're curious. And I'll go ahead and finish there. So thank you.
Thank you. So we have a number of questions which have accumulated in the chat, and they are actually starting with the first topic of your talk about unitarity. So I summarize just the two questions which came about unitarity. Renate points out that the causal dynamical triangulations, you have reflection positivity, which guarantees unitarity. So would you be happy with having reflection positivity?
Well, if you could turn that into an explanation of how we describe the unitary S matrix for ultra Planckian scattering, which forms the analog of a quantum black hole, and then gives an outgoing state that's related by something like a unitary S matrix, if you can, you know, match onto that, I think we'd be talking. So, but I think, you know, we have to be careful about just having formal statements. That's a real physical question. We could, you know, black holes really exist out there, as we've been discovering in multiple ways. And we need to figure out how to reconcile their existence and evolution with quantum mechanics. And so this is a sharp thought experiment. If you, consider an ultra high energy collision that makes something like a quantum black hole, and try to describe, you know, say what's wrong with, or what completes Hawking's description, you know, how do you do that?
The other question about unitarity is from Ding Jia, and it's basically, why require unitarity for universal quantum mechanics? What is the motivation? So I guess it's about what happens if you don't have asymptotic regions.
So a couple of comments on that. So first of all, yeah, I said unitarity in appropriate context. I think if we're describing a quantum mechanical theory, and we're in, say, a sector of that theory that is the appropriate asymptotic. So say incoming states that look like the states of, you know, just weak perturbations involving particles at t equals minus infinity to outgoing perturbations just with particles that are weakly coupled at t equals plus infinity. In that context, I would say if we don't have a unitary S matrix or analog of an S matrix, if we don't have unitarity, then we're not really talking about quantum mechanics. And concretely, when you try to write down theories that don't satisfy that kind of unitarity, you see that there are, you know, real problems. That's one of the messages of, you know, I think important messages of the history, that quantum mechanics is remarkably hard to modify. It's a remarkably rigid structure. And that's one of the things that gives me optimism that, you know, we can sort this all out, because, you know, we are pretty constrained by quantum mechanics, and modifying it seems to get us into, you know, some pretty significant trouble, you know, energy non-conservation, things like that, that just don't match up with what we see.
Okay, I'm continuing thematically. So the next is about the dressings, the next two questions. Mm-hmm. So the first one is an anonymous question, whether you can elaborate on the gravitational non-commutativity, and in particular, if that can be related to gravitational back reaction.
Yeah, it basically is. Let's go back. So it's basically, if you create an operator, or have an operator creating a particle here, then, you know, you also must create its gravitational field, and likewise for the one here. And so it really is a gravitational back reaction problem. The fact that the two, you know, don't commute is connected with the fact that sort of the part of the operator creating the gravitational field run into one another.
Okay. Another question from Antonio Duarte. Can you unmute yourself, Antonio?
Yes. Thank you. So thank you, Steve, for the nice talk. I'm wondering, so in Young-Mills theories, there are some odd proposals for these dressings of the gauge field that at the non-perturbative level suffer from some ambiguities. do you expect that this dressing that you're proposing, I mean, will be free of ambiguities at the non-perturbative level?
Well, actually, I'd be interested to know more about the ambiguities in Yang-Mills. I've described things in gravity only at the perturbative level, clearly. And I think, you know, really, yeah, when we get into the full non-perturbative story, there is considerably more subtlety here to be found. And again, that's associated with the fact that, well, going back to the picture I had, if you create a particle here and, you know, it's got a pretty sizable energy, say, or create several particles here, you're going to have a gravitational field that's strong in a surrounding region when you think non-perturbatively. You know, you're doing something like maybe even creating the gravitational field of a black hole. And so, you know, there, you know, I think there are some quite important questions. Hopefully not ambiguities when we get it all sorted out. But yeah, there is definitely a subtle story there, which still needs to be unearthed.
Okay. Staying on topic with addressing Xiangming, can you unmute yourself? No? Okay, I'm reading the question. Yes. Okay, please go ahead.
I'm wondering what's the physical meaning of the dressing? Apparently, you said it's depend on the dressing, for example, in the QED.
I'm not sure if I understand the question. The dressing is the part of the, if you have an operator which creates a particle, and say if you're in QED, mm-hmm. it's a charged particle, there's no sort of, you know, sensible description of that without its electromagnetic field. So you can have, you know, different configurations for the electromagnetic field that you create, but whenever you create a particle, if you act on the state to promote it to a state with one more charged particle, you've also got to have, for consistency, the electromagnetic field of that particle. Now, you could put all of the field lines in a line, which is what I've done in this picture here, or you could consider something more symmetric, more Coulomb-like, where it's distributed in all directions. But one way or another, you have to have some field configuration there in order to have a gauge invariant or physical operator corresponding to creation of your particle.
What I'm asking is, like, what would be a simple experiment to know different dressing, like to detect what dressing I'm choosing?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a great. Good question. Yeah, so I didn't have time to talk about that. So if you create a particle with this dressing, I think you can hopefully see where I'm pointing, then that corresponds to creating a particle with all of the field lines of electric field lines sort of in a small tube. And so if you measure the electric field, say up here, you'll get zero, but you'll see a very large electric field here. On the other hand, if you create a particle with the more symmetric dressing and then you go measure, say, the electric field up here, you'll find, say, the Coulomb value. Now, what's the physical difference between the two? Well, if you create a particle with all the field lines lined up like this, if you create that state, or create a particle in that state, well, what's going to happen? Those field lines don't want to be all lined up like that. They're going to want to spread out. So you get some radiation going out to infinity, and then it'll settle down to the Coulomb-like configuration in the asymptotic far future.
Let's move ahead in topic and change to the gravitational splitting structure you introduced. Steve Galeb, can you unmute yourself?
Okay, I think I can. So my question is, the structure that you've described depends on an epsilon. Is there a good understanding yet of the relationship of dressing, of splittings with different epsilons and the consistency conditions and limit conditions, things like that?
I think that's one of the things where there's more to do. And for example, if the epsilon's too narrow, you can end up with sort of too much stress energy in that small interface and, you know, important gravitational back reaction. But one other thing I would, so there are definitely things to think through more carefully about that. But one other just general comment I have to make, and that is, you know, when we describe manifolds in terms of open sets, there are a lot of choices we make. You know, you have to choose an atlas of open sets. And in the end, the underlying structure structure is supposed to be basically independent of which choice. You know, you can choose any atlas of open sets. And so that would be the basic notion here. But obviously there are limitations and, you know, on, and you know, probably in the end, we shouldn't be associating these Hilbert space inclusions necessarily, you know, exactly with open sets, because we don't have classical space-time anyway. We're trying to describe some other structure. That's a very good question.
Another question on this topic is from Vasudev, and I'm just going to read it in the interest of time. Saying in 3D, where pure GR is topological, can you translate that into standard TQFT axioms?
Good question. Some of this dressing story has been described there. There are important differences with the higher dimensional case, you know, because of the well-known things like, you know, no propagating gravitational field in lower dimensions and so on. Translating into TQFT is a good question. I think at least aspects of this quite possibly can be translated into that language.
Okay, another question about subsystems by Tobias. Can you unmute yourself?
Yes, I can. So I'd like to understand this proposed in terms of Hilbert space inclusions a little better. And as you said, and usually U ranges over space-time regions. What do you then propose that in a quantum case that the U ranges over? Is that a fundamental sort of piece of structure that you have this set of subsystems, or how do you think of the U?
Well, okay, so let's go back to first local quantum field theory. Then there, the fundamental structure is the Hilbert space, and then you have a set of subalgebras in, you know, their various inclusion and intersection relations and so on. And then, you know, from that, you can extract the structure of the open sets, is one way of putting it. So the notion here might be that
the subalgebras are indexed by the open sets to begin with, aren't they?
Yeah, there's a one-to-one correspondence in the case of local quantum field theory. So here, that index structure, so to speak, is, you know, shouldn't be tied fundamentally to the manifold, shouldn't be tied fundamentally to open sets on the manifold, because, you know, what I'm saying is quite possibly there isn't fundamentally a manifold in the game. That only comes out in an approximation. So that means that, you know, the basic structure should be this set of Hilbert space, say, inclusions. And then you can try to label those, you know, it's like saying, well, if you tried to label the sets in a chart on a manifold, you know, you could just abstractly give a list of them and then say how they overlap and how they include and so on and so forth and build up the manifold that way. And so the idea is that you could possibly do something like that here with the underlying Hilbert space, not factors, but at least the Hilbert spaces that you're embedding as part of the inclusion.
Okay, another question about inclusions by Laurent. Can you unmute yourself?
Yeah, I just want to comment that in some sense, this notion of quantum space time as a, you know, inclusions of growing Hilbert space or overlap is maybe one of the core idea of loop quantum gravity. So, but, you know, I want you to somehow comment on that and see how, from your perspective, you would put extra constraints or extra, you know, sets of labels that people should have looked at. What's your take on the interplay between what you're talking about and what has been already kind of devised in some cases?
Yeah, I would have to think more carefully to give a good answer to that. It's certainly true that there are some similarities with what's been done in loop quantum gravity, but, you know, there one is assuming a particular sort of, well, or in typical treatments, a particular sort of discrete structure. I don't have anything else particularly.
I'm asking maybe, you know, since you mentioned this emphasis on Poincaré, are you thinking that these Hilbert spaces, this local Hilbert space, needs to carry some certain charges, or that have to be Poincaré-like, or what are the extra necessary structure that you see
Well, in the approximation I've described, then the the factors do carry that structure. And, you know, that's in this linear or sort of leading order approximation. And so, you know, an important question is how to go beyond the leading order approximation and whether that gets modified at that level.
I just had a short question.
Laurent, sorry, we have to go on. We are already over time. So let me just try to ask Mark van Raamsdorp to unmute himself and ask a question.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. So, yeah, I just had a question about your early comments about this net of subalgebras or that kind of structure possibly giving rise to some what you need for quantum gravity. And I was wondering whether there's a distinction or whether the underlying quantum system there, does it need to be have a Hilbert space like that of a quantum field theory, or is it enough to be like quantum mechanics, or could it be finite dimensional? Do you have any comments about that?
Okay, so first let's unpack that a little bit. So the net of subalgebras, and that's kind of an established thing, is basically associated with the underlying manifold if you're talking about describing local quantum field theory on a manifold. I mean, that just full stop. That's what Hogg and company do. So what I've said is that that structure doesn't seem to quite work in gravity because you don't have commuting subalgebras. And so instead, you have a network of quite possibly of something. And the question is, what is it? And so that's where we encounter this notion that it involves these Hilbert space embeddings, because that's a way of describing the subsystems, at least in this approximation. Then there are, I think, important say finiteness conditions and so on. For example, you know, there's a smallest Hilbert space, you know, one dimensional, likewise, you do expect to have various limitations so that you're not fully building up all of the excitations that you would naively describe in a local quantum field theory. We know that if we try to put too many excitations in a region in the context of gravity, there's something wrong with that. And I think you expect to run into those limitations directly in this structure here in gravity, but part of the question is really exploring how that works when you go beyond the leading perturbative story.
Okay, thanks.
Roberto?
Yeah, so you started in the beginning by talking just about very abstract notions like Hilbert spaces and quantum mechanics, and then you went rather quickly into the full-fledged formalism of quantum theory. So there must have been some intermediate stage there. Now, in particular, some of the questions I had have already been asked and answered, but in particular, I wanted to know where does Newton constant appear, because Newton constant is not there in quantum mechanics.
Let me again try to explain the basic picture. So if we're talking about quantum gravity, the view is there, you know, it should be described by a Hilbert space. At least that's what I'm advocating. That's what we mean by a quantum theory. And then of gravity, well, there's some more structure. So if we're talking about field theory, of course, you know, where does the structure of the couplings and so on come in? It comes in, you know, properties of these observables and their time evolution in the context of field theory and so on. When we move to gravity, Newton's constant does play a role, and it's, you know, sort of describing, in one way of putting it, the deformation away from the commutative structure you have in field theory is one way of saying it. But, you know, of course, it, you know, plays a direct role in describing, related to that, the size of the dressing of operators, which is going to basically tell you, the extent to which these different subsystems are connected in some sense. So
Okay, so anyway, it's a fundamental constant of nature, and it's not, for example, the expectation value of some field.
Not in the viewpoint that I'm exploring here. Yeah, it's just it's part of the description of the theory. It's a and it has a dimension, so it sets a scale and so on, and that's part of the fundamental physics.
Okay, the last question by Lee, and before that, let me remind you of the Slack channel and of the afternoon discussion room, which I posted the links in the chat. Lee, can you unmute yourself?
Yes, I just wanted to echo what Laurent was saying. I did unmute myself. Did it record it? According to my computer, I'm not muted. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
We can hear you.
Good. So I just want to echo what Laurent said, and I'm not just reflexively trying to defend loop quantum gravity, but I really have the sense that the precise...
No, we can't hear you.
Froze.
...structure that is used there, and the following structures of graphs, regions, and the interplay of that.
Okay, Lee, you are vanishing.
Pretty close to what I understand you're looking for.
Okay. Did you go to that, Steve?
Can you hear me?
Parts.
Let me just say it again very loudly. This is meant as a friendly suggestion that the structure that was developed in loop quantum gravity of embeddings of Hilbert spaces within Hilbert spaces in the with spatial diffeomorphisms strikes me as precisely what you're looking for.
Maybe to say one other comment to sort of highlight some of the questions. I sort of expect in this story that, say, in an appropriate sector, there is a state that corresponds to something like Minkowski space. And in quantum gravity, that's kind of one of the challenges, with the discrete structure in loop quantum gravity, how to, really think about Minkowski space and small perturbations about it.
And I don't think so.
Okay, well.
Let's talk about that.
Okay.
Okay, everyone is invited to continue the discussion on in Remo or on the Slack channel. I thank everyone for being here, and let's thank Steve again.